for me. Welcome to A Thunder Perfect Mood here on WMFO Medford. I am your host, Marie Moon. I am delighted to be with you this evening playing some Human League. That song was called Empire State Human. Tonight, we continue Dune Part 3. We're going to be hanging out with Leah Kynes. We're going to be checking out some sand crawlers, some spice miners. It's going to be real. I will be hopping around a tiny bit, but not too much tonight. If you just so happen to be reading along with me in a similar edition of Dune, black cover, vertical rectangle of sand, I'm beginning on page 105 tonight. Let's do this.
My father, the Padishah Emperor, took me by the hand one day and I sensed in the ways my mother had taught me that he was disturbed. He led me down the hall of the portraits to the ego-likeness of the Duke Leto Atreides. I marked the strong resemblance between them, my father and this man in the portrait, both with thin, elegant faces and sharp features dominated by cold eyes. "Princess daughter," my father said, "I would that you'd been older when it came time for this man to choose a woman." My father was 71 at the time, and looking no older than the man in this portrait, and I was but 14. Yet I remember deducing in that instant that my father secretly wished the Duke had been his son, and disliked the political necessities that made them enemies. In my father's house, by the Princess Irulan. His first encounter with the people he had been ordered to betray left Dr. Kynes shaken. He prided himself on being a scientist, to whom legends were merely interesting clues, pointing toward cultural roots. Yet the boy fitted the ancient prophecy so precisely. He had the questing eyes and the air of reserved candor. Of course, the prophecy left a certain latitude as to whether the mother goddess would bring the Messiah with her or produce him on the scene. Still, there was this odd correspondence between prediction and persons. They met in mid-morning outside the Arakeen Landing Field's administration building. An unmarked ornithopter squatted nearby, humming softly on standby like a somnolent insect. An Atreides guard stood beside it with bared sword and the faint air distortion of a shield around him. Kynes sneered at the shield pattern, thinking, "Arrakis has a surprise for them there." The planetologist raised a hand, signaled for his Fremen guard to fall back. He strode on ahead toward the building's entrance, the dark hole in plastic-coated rock. So exposed, that monolithic building, he thought, so much less suitable than a cave. Movement within the entrance caught his attention. He stopped, taking the moment to adjust his robe and the set of his stillsuit at his left shoulder. The entrance doors swung wide. Atreides guards emerged swiftly, all of them heavily armed, slow pellet stunners, swords, and shields. Behind them came a tall man, hawk-faced, dark of skin and hair. He wore a jubba cloak with the Atreides crest at the breast and wore it in a way that betrayed his unfamiliarity with the garment. It clung to the legs of his stillsuit at one side. It lacked a free, swinging, striding rhythm. Beside the man walked a youth with the same dark hair, but rounder in the face. The youth seemed small for the 15 years Kynes knew him to have, but the young body carried a sense of command, a poised assurance, as though he saw and knew things all around him that were not visible to others. And he wore the same style cloak as his father, yet with casual ease that made one think the boy had always worn such clothing. "The Mahdi will be aware of things others cannot see," went the prophecy. Kynes shook his head, telling himself, "They're just people." With the two, garbed like them for the desert, came a man Kynes recognized, Gurney Halleck. Kynes took a deep breath to still his resentment against Halleck, who had briefed him on how to behave with the Duke and the ducal heir. "You may call the Duke my lord or sire. Noble-born also is correct, but usually reserved for more formal occasions. The son may be addressed as young master or my lord. The Duke is a man of much leniency, but brooks little familiarity." And Kynes thought as he watched the group approach, "They'll learn soon enough who's master on Arrakis. Order me questions half the night by that mentat, will they? Expect me to guide them on an inspection of spice mining, do they?" The import of Hawat's questions had not escaped Kynes. They wanted the Imperial bases, and it was obvious they learned of the bases from Idaho. "I will have Stilgar send Idaho's head to this Duke," Kynes told himself. The ducal party was only a few paces away now, their feet in desert boots crunching the sand. Kynes bowed. "My lord, Duke." As he had approached the solitary figure standing near the ornithopter, Leto had studied him. Tall, thin, dressed for the desert in loose robe, stillsuit, and low boots. The man's hood was thrown back, its veil hanging to one side, revealing long sandy hair, a sparse beard. The eyes were that fathomless blue within blue under thick brows. Remains of dark stains smudged his eye sockets. "You're the ecologist," the Duke said. "We prefer the old title here, my lord," Kynes said. "Planetologist."
"As you wish," the Duke said.
He glanced down at Paul. "Son, this is the judge of the change, the arbiter of dispute, the man set here to see that the forms are obeyed in our assumption of power over this fief." He glanced at Kynes.
"And this is my son."
"My lord," Kynes said. "Are you a Fremen?" Paul asked. Kynes smiled. "I am accepted in both Siege and Village, young master. But I am in His Majesty's service, the Imperial Planetologist." Paul nodded, impressed by the man's air of strength. Halleck had pointed Kynes out to Paul from an upper window of the administration building. "The man standing there with the Fremen escort, the one moving now toward the ornithopter." Paul had inspected Kynes briefly with binoculars, noting the prim, straight mouth, the high forehead. Halleck had spoken in Paul's ear. "Odd sort of fellow. He has a precise way of speaking, clipped off, no fuzzy edges, razor apt." And the Duke, beside them, had said, "Scientist type." Now only a few feet from this man, Paul sensed the power in Kynes, the impact of personality, as though he were blood royal, born to command. "I understand we have you to thank for our stillsuits and these cloaks," the Duke said. "I hope they fit well, my lord," Kynes said. "They're of Fremen make, and as near as possible the dimensions given to me by your man Halleck here." "I was concerned that you said you couldn't take us into the desert unless we wore these garments," the Duke said. "We can carry plenty of water. We don't intend to be out long, and we'll have air cover, the escort you see overhead right now. It isn't likely we'll be forced down." Kynes stared at him, seeing the water-fat flesh. He spoke coldly. "You never talk of likelihoods on Arrakis. You speak only of possibilities." Halleck stiffened.
"The Duke is to be addressed as my lord or sire."
Leto gave Halleck their private hand signal to desist. Said, "Our ways are new here, Gurney. We must make allowances."
"As you wish, sire."
"We are indebted to you, Dr. Kynes," Leto said. "These suits and the consideration for our welfare will be remembered." On impulse, Paul called to mind a quotation from the OC Bible, said, "The gift is the blessing of the river." The words rang out over loud in the still air. The Fremen escort Kynes had left in the shade of the administration building leaped up from their squatting repose, muttering in open agitation. One cried out, "Lizan al-Ghaib!" Kynes whirled, gave a curt chopping signal with a hand, waved the guard away. They fell back, grumbling among themselves, trailed away around the building.
"Most interesting," Leto said.
Kynes passed a hard glare over the Duke and Paul, said, "Most of the desert natives here are a superstitious lot. Pay no attention to them. They mean no harm." But he thought of the words of the legend. "They will greet you with holy words, and your gifts will be a blessing." Leto's assessment of Kynes, based partly on Hawat's brief verbal report, guarded and full of suspicions, suddenly crystallized. The man was Fremen. Kynes had come with a Fremen escort, which could mean simply that the Fremen were testing their new freedom to enter urban areas, but it had seemed an honor guard. And by his manner, Kynes was a proud man, accustomed to freedom, his tongue and his manner guarded only by his own suspicions. Paul's question had been direct and pertinent. Kynes had gone native.
"Shouldn't we be going, sire?" Halleck asked.
The Duke nodded.
"I'll fly my own thopter.
Kynes can sit up front with me to direct me. You and Paul take the rear seats."
"One moment, please," Kynes said. "With your permission, sire, I must check the security of your suits."
The Duke started to speak, but Kynes pressed on. "I have concern for my own flesh as well as yours, my lord. I'm well aware whose throat would be slit should harm befall you too, while you're in my care."
The Duke frowned, thinking, "How delicate this moment. If I refuse, it may offend him. And this could be a man whose value to me is beyond measure. Yet, to let him inside my shield, touching my person when I know so little about him."
Thoughts flickered through his mind with decision hard on their heels.
"We're in your hands," the Duke said.
He stepped forward, opening his robe, saw Halleck come up on the balls of his feet, poised and alert, but remaining where he was.
"And if you'd be so kind," the Duke said, "I'd appreciate an explanation of the suit from one who lives so intimately with it."
"Certainly," Kynes said. He felt up under the robe for the shoulder seals, speaking as he examined the suit. "It's basically a micro sandwich, a high-efficiency filter and heat exchange system." He adjusted the shoulder seals. "The skin contact layer's porous. Perspiration passes through it, having cooled the body. Near normal evaporation process. The next two layers," Kynes tightened the chest fit, "include heat exchange filaments and salt precipitators. Salt's reclaimed."
The Duke lifted his arm at a gesture, said, "Most interesting."
"Breathe deeply," Kynes said.
The Duke obeyed. Kynes studied the underarm seals, adjusted one. "Motions of the body, especially breathing," he said, "and some osmotic action provide the pumping force." He loosened the chest fit slightly. "Reclaimed water circulates to catch pockets from which you draw it through this tube in the clip at your neck." The Duke twisted his chin in and down to look at the end of the tube.
"Efficient and convenient," he said. "Good engineering."
Kynes knelt, examined the leg seals.
"Urine and feces are processed in the thigh pads," he said, and stood up.
Felt the neck fitting, lifted a section flap there. "In the open desert, you wear this filter across your face, this tube in the nostrils with these plugs to ensure a tight fit. Breathe in through the mouth filter, out through the nose tube. With a Fremen suit in good working order, you won't lose more than a thimbleful of moisture a day, even if you're caught in the Great Urg."
"A thimbleful a day," the Duke said.
Kynes pressed a finger against the suit's forehead pad, said, "This may rub a little. If it irritates you, please tell me. I could slip patch it a bit tighter."
"My thanks," the Duke said.
He moved his shoulders in the suit as Kynes stepped back, realizing that it did feel better now, tighter and less irritating. Kynes turned to Paul. "Now let's have a look at you, lad."
"A good man, but he'll have to learn to address us properly," the Duke thought.
Paul stood passively as Kynes inspected the suit. It had been an odd sensation putting on the crinkling, slick-surfaced garment. In his foreconsciousness had been the absolute knowledge that he had never before worn a stillsuit. Yet each motion of adjusting the adhesion tabs under Gurney's inexpert guidance had seemed natural, instinctive. When he had tightened the chest to gain maximum pumping action from the motion of breathing, he had known what he did and why. When he had fitted the neck and forehead tabs tightly, he had known it was to prevent friction blisters.
Kynes straightened, stepped back with a puzzled expression. "You've worn a still suit before?" he asked.
"This is the first time."
"Then someone adjusted it for you?"
"No."
"Your desert boots are fitted slip fashion at the ankles. Who told you to do that?"
"It seemed the right way."
That it most certainly is. And Kynes rubbed his cheek, thinking of the legend, "He shall know your ways as though born to them." "We waste time," the Duke said. He gestured to the waiting thopter, led the way, accepting the guard's salute with a nod. He climbed in, fastened his safety harness, checked controls and instruments. The craft creaked as the others clambered aboard. Kynes fastened his harness, focused on the padded comfort of the aircraft, soft luxury of gray-green upholstery, gleaming instruments, the sensation of filtered and washed air in his lungs as doors slammed and vent fans whirred alive. So soft, he thought.
"All secure, sire," Halleck said.
Leto fed power to the wings, felt them cup and dip. Once, twice, they were airborne in 10 meters, wings feathered tightly and afterjets thrusting them upward in steep, hissing climb. "Southeast over the shield wall," Kynes said. "That's where I told your sandmaster to concentrate his equipment." "Right." the Duke banked into his air cover, the other craft taking up their guard positions as they headed southeast. The design and manufacture of these still suits bespeaks a high degree of sophistication, the Duke said. Someday I may show you a siege factory, Kynes said. I would find that interesting, the Duke said. I note that suits are manufactured also in some of the garrison cities. Inferior copies, Kynes said. Any Dune man who values his skin wears a Fremen suit.
I've seen a hand, I've seen a vision. It was reaching through the clouds to risk a dream. The shadow crossed the sky and it crushed it to the ground, just like a beast. The old man's back again. The old man's back again. I seen a woman standing in the snow. She was silent as she watched them take her man. Teardrops burned her cheeks, for she thought she'd heard the shadow had left this land. The old man's back again. The old man's back again. The crowds just gathered, their faces turned away, and they queue all day like dragons of disgust. Older women whispering, wondering just what these young hotheads want of us. And Andre V, he cries, with eyes that ring like chimes. His anti-worlds go spinning through his head. He burns them in his dreams, for half awake, they may as well be dead. The old man's back again. I see he's back again. I see a soldier, he's standing in the rain. For him there's no old man to walk behind. Devoured by his pain, bewildered by the faces who pass him by. He'd like another name, the one he's got's a curse, these people cry. Why can't they understand? His mother called him Ivan, then she died. The old man's back again. The old man's back again. I can see him back again.
We are duning, duning hard, on a thunder-perfect mood on WMFO Medford. I am still Marie Moon. We are reading part three of a 13-part read-along Dune. Tune in for some of it, tune in for all of it. Check out past episodes on thunderperfectmood.com. Or don't. Just enjoy your life. We're listening to Magic Arrow by Timber Tumber. Before that was The Old Man's Back Again by Scott Walker. And The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face by Roberta Flack. Number 5 by Aphex Twin from his Ambient Works album that I'm getting a lot of use out of this book reading. Before that was a track called Concert at Phil Niblock's Loft by Susan Chani, who I love. Bagatellen number 4, I believe. We continue with Dune. You're on WMFO Medford.
Dust cloud ahead, sire. I see it, Gurney.
That's what we seek, Kine said. Paul stretched up in the seat to peer ahead, saw a rolling yellow cloud low on the desert surface some kilometers ahead. One of your factory crawlers, Kine said. It's on the surface, and that means it's on spice. The cloud is vented sand being expelled after the spice has been centrifugally removed. There's no other cloud quite like it.
Aircraft over it, the Duke said.
I see 2, 3, 4 spotters, Kine said. They're watching for worm sign.
Worm sign? The Duke asked.
A sand wave moving towards the crawler.
They'll have seismic probes on the surface, too. Worms sometimes travel too deep for the wave to show. Kine swung his gaze around the sky. Should be a carry-all wing around, but I don't see it.
The worms always come, eh? Halleck asked.
Always. Paul leaned forward, touched Kine's shoulder. How big an area does each worm stake out?
Kine frowned.
The child kept asking adult questions. That depends on the size of the worm.
What's the variation? The Duke asked.
Big ones may control 300 or 400 square kilometers. Small ones... He broke off as the Duke kicked on the jet brakes. The ship bucked as its tail pods whispered to silence. Stub wings elongated, cupped the air. The craft became a full thopter as the Duke banked it, holding the wings to a gentle beat, pointing with his left hand off to the east beyond the factory crawler.
Is that worm sign?
Kynes leaned across the Duke to peer into the distance. Paul and Halleck were crowded together, looking in the same direction, and Paul noted that their escort, caught by the sudden maneuver, had surged ahead, but now was curving back. The factory crawler lay ahead of them, still some 3 kilometers away. Where the Duke pointed, crescent dune tracks spread shadow ripples toward the horizon, and running through them as a level line stretching into the distance, came an elongated mount in motion, a cresting of sand. It reminded Paul of the way a big fish disturbed the water when swimming just under the surface.
Worm, Kine said.
Big one. He leaned back, grabbed the microphone from the panel, punched out a new frequency selection. Glancing at the grid chart on the rollers over their heads, he spoke into the microphone. Calling crawler at Delta Ajax Niner. Worm sign warning. Acknowledge, please. He waited. The panel speaker emitted static crackles, then a voice.
Who calls Delta Ajax Niner? Over.
They seem pretty calm about it, Halleck said. Kine spoke into the microphone. Unlisted flight, north and east of you about 3 kilometers. Worm sign is on intercept, of course. Your position... Estimated contact 25 minutes. Another voice rumbled from the speaker.
This is spotter control. Sighting confirmed. Stand by for contact fix.
There was a pause, then...
Contact in 26 minutes minus. Please be well, that was a sharp estimate. He's on that unlisted flight, over.
Halleck had his harness off and surged forward between Kynes and the Duke.
Once you've seen what
is this the regular working frequency, Kynes? Yes, what? Who'd be listening? Just the work crews in this area? Cuts down interference. Again, the speaker crackled, then...
Look around, you find the ground is not so far from where you are.
Halleck glanced at the Duke. Kine said, there's a bonus based on spice load for whoever gives first worm warning. They want to know. Tell them who had first sight of that worm, Halleck said. The Duke nodded.
Kynes hesitated, then lifted the microphone. Spotter credit to the Duke Leto Atreides. The Duke Leto Atreides. Over. The voice from the speaker was flat, partly distorted by a burst of static.
We read, and thank you.
Now tell them to divide the bonus among themselves, Alec ordered. Tell them it's the Duke's wish. Kynes took a deep breath, then... It's the Duke's wish that you divide the bonus among your crew. Do you read? Over.
Acknowledged and thank you.
The speaker said. The Duke said, I forgot to mention that Gurney is also very talented in public relations. Kynes turned a puzzled frown on Halleck. This lets the men know their Duke is concerned for their safety, Halleck said. Word will get around. It was on an area working frequency. Not likely Harkonnen agents heard. He glanced out at their air cover. And we're a pretty strong force. It was a good risk. The Duke banked their craft toward the sand cloud erupting from the factory crawler. What happens now? There's a carry-all wing somewhere close, Kynes said. It'll come in and lift off the crawler. What if the carry-all's wrecked? Some equipment is lost, Kynes said. Get in close over the crawler, my lord. You'll find this interesting. Duke scowled, busied himself with the controls as they came into turbulent air over the crawler. Paul looked down, saw sand still spewing out from the metal and plastic monster beneath them. It looked like a great tan and blue beetle with many wide tracks extending on arms around it. He saw a giant inverted funnel snout poked into dark sand in front of him. Rich spice bed by the color, Kynes said. They'll continue working until the last minute. The Duke fed more power to the wings, stiffened them for a steeper descent as he settled lower in a circling glide above the crawler. Glance left and right showed his cover holding altitude and circling overhead. Paul studied the yellow cloud belching from the crawler's pipe vents, looked out over the desert at the approaching warm track. Shouldn't we be hearing them call in the carry-all? Halleck asked. They usually have the wing on a different frequency, Kynes said. Shouldn't they have two carry-alls standing by for every crawler? The Duke asked. There should be 26 men on that machine down there, not to mention the cost of equipment. Kynes said, you don't have enough ex... He broke off as the speaker erupted with an angry voice.
Any of you see the wing? He isn't answering.
A garble of noise crackled from the speaker, drowned in an abrupt override signal, then silence, and the first voice.
Report by the numbers. Over. This is Spotter Control. Last I saw, the wing was pretty high and circling off northwest. I don't see him now. Over. Spotter 1, negative. Over. Spotter 2, negative. Over. Spotter 3, negative. Over.
Silence. The Duke looked down. His own craft's shadow was just passing over the crawler. Only 4 spotters, is that right? Correct, Kynes said. There are 5 in our party, the Duke said. Our ships are larger. We can crowd in 3 extra each. Their spotters ought to be able to lift off 2 each. Paul did the arithmetic, said. That's 3 short. Why don't they have 2 carry-alls to each crawler? Barked the Duke. You don't have enough extra equipment, Kynes said. All the more reason we should protect what we have. Where could that carry-all go? Halleck asked. Could have been forced down somewhere out of sight, Kynes said. The Duke grabbed the microphone, hesitated with thumb poised over its switch. How could they lose sight of a carry-all? They keep their attention on the ground, looking for worm sign, Kynes said. The Duke thumbed the switch, spoke into the microphone. This is your Duke. We are coming down to take off Delta Ajax Niner's crew. All spotters are ordered to comply. Spotters will land on the east side. We will take the west. Over. He reached down, punched out his own command frequency, repeated the order for his own air cover, handed the microphone back to Kynes. Kynes returned to the working frequency, and a voice blasted from the speaker.
Almost a full load of spice. We have almost a full load. We can't leave that for a damned worm. Over.
Damn the spice, the Duke barked. He grabbed back the microphone, said, We can always get more spice. There are seats in our ship for all but three of you. Draw straws or decide any way you'd like who's to go. But you're going, and that's an order. He slammed the microphone back into Kynes' hands, muttered, Sorry, as Kynes shook an injured finger. How much time? Paul asked. 9 minutes, Kynes said. The Duke said, This ship has more power than the others. If we took off under jet with three-quarter wings, we could crowd in an additional man. That sand's soft, Kynes said. With four extra men aboard on a jet takeoff, we could snap the wings, sire, Halleck said. Not on this ship, the Duke said. He hauled back on the controls as the thopter glided in beside the crawler. The wings tipped up, braked the thopter to a skidding stop within 20 meters of the factory. The crawler was silent now, no sand spouting from its vents. Only a faint mechanical rumble issued from it, becoming more audible as the Duke opened his door. Immediately, their nostrils were assailed by the odor of cinnamon, heavy and pungent. With a loud flapping, the spotter aircraft glided down to the sand on the other side of the crawler. The Duke's own escort swooped in to land in line with him. Paul, looking out at the factory, saw how all the thopters were dwarfed by it, gnats beside a warrior beetle. Gurney, you and Paul toss out that rear seat, the Duke said. He manually cranked the wings out to three quarters, set their angle, checked the jet pod controls. Why the devil aren't they coming out of that machine? They're hoping the carry-all will show up, Kynes said. They still have a few minutes. He glanced off to the east. All turned to look the same direction, seeing no sign of the worm, but there was a heavy, charged feeling of anxiety in the air. The Duke took the microphone, punched for his command frequency, and said, Two of you toss out your shield generators. By the numbers, you can carry one more man that way. We're not leaving any men for that monster. He keyed back to the working frequency, barked. All right, you and Delta Ajax Niner, out. Now. This is a command from your Duke. On the double or I'll cut that crawler apart with a laser gun. A hatch snapped open near the front of the factory, another at the rear, another at the top. Men came tumbling out, sliding and scrambling down to the sand. A tall man in patched working robe was the last to emerge. He jumped down to a track and then to the sand. The Duke hung the microphone on the panel, swung out onto the wing step, shouted, Two men each into your spotters. The man in the patched robe began tolling off pairs of his crew, pushing them toward the craft, waiting on the other side. Four over here! The Duke shouted. Four into that ship back there! He jabbed a finger at an escort thopter directly behind him. The guards were just wrestling the shield generator out of it. And four into that ship over there! He pointed to the other escort that had shed its shield generator. Three each into the others! Run, you sand dogs! The tall man, finished counting off his crew, came slogging across the sand, followed by three of his companions. I hear the worm, but I can't see it, Kynes said. The others heard it then, an abrasive slithering, distant and growing louder. Damn sloppy way to operate, the Duke muttered. Aircraft began flapping off the sand around them. It reminded the Duke of a time on his home planet's jungles, a sudden emergence into a clearing, and carrion birds lifting away from the carcass of a wild ox. The spice workers slogged up to the side of the thopter, started climbing in behind the Duke. Halleck helped, dragging them into the rear. In you go, boys, he snapped, on the double. Paul, crowded into the corner by sweating men, smelled the perspiration of fear. saw that two of the men had poor neck adjustments on their stillsuits. He filed the information in his memory for future action. His father would have to order tighter stillsuit discipline. Men tended to become sloppy if he didn't watch such things. The last man came gasping into the rear, said, "The worm! It's almost on us! Blast off!" The Duke slid into his seat, frowning, and said, "We still have almost 3 minutes on the original contact estimate. Is that right, Kynes?" He shut his door, checked it. "Almost exactly, my lord," Kynes said, and he thought, "A cool one, this Duke." "All secure here, sire," Halleck said. The Duke nodded, watched the last of his escort take off. He adjusted the igniter, glanced once more at wings and instruments, punched the jet sequence. The takeoff pressed the Duke and Kynes deep into their seats, compressed the people in the rear. Kynes watched the way the Duke handled the controls. Gently, surely. The thopter was fully airborne now, and the Duke studied his instruments, glanced left and right at his wings. "She's very heavy, sire," Halleck said. "Well within the tolerances of this ship," the Duke said. "You didn't really think I'd risk this cargo, did you, Gurney?" Halleck grinned, said, "Not a bit, sire." The Duke banked his craft in a long, easy curve, climbing over the crawler. Paul, crushed into a corner beside a window, stared down at the silent machine on the sand. The worm sign had broken off about 400 meters from the crawler, and now there appeared to be turbulence in the sand around the factory. "The worm is now beneath the crawler," Kynes said. "You are about to witness a thing few have seen." Flecks of dust shadowed the sand around the crawler now. The big machine began to tip down to the right. A gigantic sand whirlpool began forming there, to the right of the crawler. It moved faster and faster. Sand and dust filled the air now for hundreds of meters around. Then they saw it. A wide hole emerged from the sand. Sunlight flashed from glistening white spokes within it. The hole's diameter was at least twice the length of the crawler, Paul estimated. He watched as the machine slid into that opening in a billow of dust and sand. The hole pulled back. "Gods, what a monster," muttered a man beside Paul. "Got all our flogging spice," growled another. "Someone is going to pay for this," the Duke said. "I promise you that." By the very flatness of his father's voice, Paul sensed the deep anger. He found that he shared it. This was criminal waste. In the silence that followed, they heard Kynes. "Bless the Maker and his water," Kynes murmured. "Bless the coming and the going of him. May his passage cleanse the world. May he keep the world for his people." "What's that you're saying?" the Duke asked. But Kynes remained silent. Paul glanced at the men crowded around him. They were staring fearfully at the back of Kynes' head. One of them whispered, "Liette." Kynes turned, scowling. The man sank back, abashed. Another of the rescued men began coughing, dry and rasping. Presently he gasped, "Curse this hellhole!" The tall dune man who had come last out of the crawler said, "Be you still, Koss. You but worse in your cough." He stirred among the men until he could look through them at the back of the Duke's head. "You be the Duke Leto, I warrant," he said. "It's to you we give thanks for our lives. We were ready to end it there until you came along." "Quiet, man, and let the Duke fly his ship," Halleck muttered. Paul glanced at Halleck. He, too, had seen the tension wrinkles at the corner of his father's jaw. One walked softly when the Duke was in a rage. Leto began easing his thopter out of its great banking circle, stopped at a new sign of movement on the sand. the worm had withdrawn into the depths, and now, near where the crawler had been, two figures could be seen moving north away from the sand depression. They appeared to glide over the surface with hardly a lifting of dust to mark their passage.
"Who's that down there?" the Duke barked.
"Two Johnnies who came along for the ride, Sor," said the tall dune man.
"Why wasn't something said about them?"
"It was the chance they took, Sor," the dune man said. "My lord," said Kynes, "these men know it's of little use to do anything about men trapped on the desert in worm country."
"We'll send a ship from base for them," the Duke snapped.
"As you wish, my lord," Kynes said. "But likely when the ship gets here, there'll be no one to rescue."
"We'll send the ship anyway," the Duke said.
"They were right beside when the worm came up," Paul said. "How'd they escape?" "The sides of the hole cave in and make the distances deceptive," Kynes said.
"You waste fuel here, sire," Halleck ventured.
"Aye, Gurney."
The Duke brought his craft around toward the shield wall. His escort came down from circling stations, took up positions above and on both sides. Paul thought about what the dune man and Kynes had said. He sensed half-truths, outright lies. The men on the sand had glided across the surface so surely, moving in a way obviously calculated to keep from luring the worm back out of its depths. Fremen, Paul thought. Who else would be so sure on the sand? Who else might be left out of your worries as a matter of course? Because they are in no danger. They know how to live here. They know how to outwit the worm.
What were Fremen doing on that crawler? Paul asked.
Kynes whirled. The tall dune man turned wide eyes on Paul, blue within blue within blue.
"Who be this lad?" he asked.
Halleck moved to place himself between the man and Paul, said.
"This is Paul Atreides, the ducal heir."
"Why says he there were Fremen on our rumbler?" the man asked.
"They fit the description," Paul said.
Kynes snorted. "You can't tell Fremen just by looking at them."
He looked at the dune man.
"You, who were those men?"
"Friends of one of the others," the dune man said. "Just friends from a village who wanted to see the spice sands."
Kynes turned away.
"Fremen!"
But he was remembering the words of the legend. "The Lizan al-Ghaib shall see through all subterfuge."
"They be dead now, most likely, young Sur," the dune man said. "We should not speak unkindly on them."
But Paul heard the falsehood in their voices, felt the menace that had brought Halleck instinctively into guarding position. Paul spoke dryly. "A terrible place for them to die." Without warning, Kynes said, "When God hath ordained a creature to die in a particular place, he causeth that creature's wants to direct him to that place." Leto turned a hard stare at Kynes. And Kynes, returning the stare, found himself troubled by a fact he had observed here. This Duke was concerned more over the men than he was over the spice. He risked his own life and that of his son to save the men. He passed off the loss of a spice crawler with a gesture. The threat to men's lives had him in a rage. A leader such as that would command fanatic loyalty. He would be difficult to defeat. Against his own will and all previous judgments, Kynes admitted to himself, "I like this Duke."
Canned vegetables, bring them. Okay. Hey, Duncan, get over here. Need you to stay with me and your brother, okay?
I am.
Well, closer. Come on, help me out here, buddy. Excuse me. Duncan, you're blocking me out.
I want some bologna.
Not today.